Brian Zonwalt was born in Tulare, California in 1920. He was high school valedictorian in 1938 and graduated cum laude from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1942. At the age of 44, he was the youngest naval officer ever promoted to rear admiral. And at the age of 49, he was the youngest four-star admiral in U.S. naval history and the youngest to serve as chief of naval operations. In the Second World War in the USS Robinson, he was awarded the Bronze Star with Combat V for heroic service. In the Korean War, as a navigator of USS Wisconsin, he received a letter of commendation with ribbon and Combat V from Commander 7th Fleet. Part of that letter states, his performance of duty was consistently superior in bringing his ship through dangerously lined and restricted waters, frequently under adverse conditions and poor visibility. After his selection to the rank of Rear Admiral, he assumed command of Cruiser Destroyer Flotilla 7. He was awarded a Gold Star in lieu of a Second Legion of Merit, and later in another capacity the Distinguished Service Medal. In September 68, he became Commander Naval Forces Vietnam and Chief of the Naval Advisory Group, U.S. Military Assistance. In April 1970, President Nixon appointed him Chief of Naval Operations, and he was awarded a Gold Star in lieu of a Second Distinguished Service Medal for exceptionally meritorious service. His home is in Arlington, Virginia. He is today president of Admiral Zumwalt and Associates, a firm consulting in a number of areas. He is also serving as a director of a number of other corporations, both private and public. He's the author of two books, the most recent of which, My Father, My Son, written in partnership with his son, Elmo Zumwalt III, was the subject of his talk yesterday. Admiral Zumwalt.
Thank you very much. When I was running the Navy, Musa and I were flown to Houston on one occasion where I gave a speech and spent the night with friends with whom we had never stayed before. I got up the next morning on a dark winter morning to do my three-mile run, ran out a mile and a half, ran back a mile and a half, and couldn't find the house. Realized I hadn't noted the street name. Didn't have any money in my jogging clothes to make a telephone call. I went into a circular search pattern. After about 30 minutes, an old gentleman in a panel truck drove up and stopped in front of a house that was being built. I went up to him and said, "Excuse me, sir, I lost my way from the Paul Howells. Can you give me a hand?" He said, "I don't know where they live, but I'll be glad to open up the construction shack and we'll look them up in the phone book." He did and handed me the book, and I said, "Excuse me, I don't have my glasses. Would you mind looking them up?" He did, and they weren't listed. But this time I felt as though I were in a twilight zone, and then a stroke of genius overtook me, and I picked up the telephone and dialed my office in the Pentagon Collect. Chief Yeoman answered the phone, and I said, "Chief, don't ask me any questions. Just find Commander Woodbury and ask him where I spent last night." Commander Woodbury came on the phone in a minute and said, "Admiral, you're a terrible problem to your aides. Do you have any idea if you're still in the city of Houston?" I said, "All right, wise ass, just give me the address," which he did. I wrote it down and handed it to the old gentleman. He said, "That's about six blocks from here. Get in the truck and I'll drive you." He started up the truck and looked at me and said, "By the way, what do you do for a living?" I said, "Well, I run the United States Navy." He said, "Huh, you don't know where you live. Can't read and you expect me to buy that?" So having properly denigrated myself, having listened to a number of fascinating insights about what's going on with regard to glasnost and perestroika and different perceptions as to how fast the system is going to become unraveled, which I all think we agree it will, I think that it's important to try to understand better one of the most significant support systems that any leader in the Soviet Union has in its present undemocratic state, and that is the military institution. Traditionally, a leader comes to power by manipulating properly a combination of the KGB, the party leaders, and the military leaders. And in even with the now more powerful position of the state government, I don't think that there's any doubt but what a coup against Gorbachev would have to be brought about by making sure that the military are involved in it. I think one of the important things then in order to understand the military whose leadership comes from my generation, namely experience in World War II, that it's important to try to understand what their perspectives are. Those of us on both sides went through that war, saw the United States at the end of the war literally overnight turn itself from the world's number one power into inferiority by demobilizing, and the Soviet Union maintain its power by keeping its legions intact, as a result of which, by a combination of power and policy, Stalin was able to overrun one country after another until he had, by the end of World War II, incorporated Ukraine, Outer Mongolia, Latvia, Lithuania, Ethiopia, East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary into the Soviet Empire, a total of 11 nations. In the 50s, he, of course, sought further to build that empire by authorizing the North Korean invasion of South Korea, and gave some help to the beginnings of the revolutionary activity in Vietnam. In the 60s, the Vietnam activity increased dramatically. The Cuban Missile Crisis, which was defeated, the Soviet venture, in an effort to double the megatonnage and cut in half the warning time, was another lesson to both sides, following which the Soviet Union began their huge buildup of both nuclear and maritime capability to match their always superior conventional forces in Europe. And because of the increasing danger of the nuclear confrontation, Khrushchev began to enunciate his doctrine of wars of national liberation, meaning that too dangerous to fight nuclear wars, too risky to fight conventional wars because of the possibility of escalation. So let's find the areas where the combination of a power vacuum and discontent will let us move in and begin to whittle real estate away from the West and bring it back behind the Iron Curtain. In the 70s, we had the debacle of Vietnam, a great success for Soviet policy, the result of their putting $1 to $2 billion a year into an effort that was costing us in excess of $30 billion a year, and of the very astute advice they gave Hanoi about how to carry on that war. And in the power vacuum that resulted from the loss of that war and the tremendous discontent associated with it, we saw another huge tier of nations go behind the Iron Curtain in the perspective of influence: Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Yemen, Afghanistan, and Nicaragua. And we saw, of course, Brezhnev smash the first feeble effort at lightening the system inside the Soviet Union when Khrushchev was eliminated. And we saw the false detente of that period. I agree very much with Professor Leonard that when you see internal factors of such totalitarian nature as were going on then, it was very naive of us to believe that detente could have been intended to be anything except an effort to gain unilateral advantage on their part. During that period, those of us on the Joint Chiefs of Staff were reporting to the Congress and the President of the United States that we had fallen to about a 35% probability of victory in a naval war, about a 50% probability of a victory in an air war, and that it was only a question of how many weeks it would take the Russians to reach the channel in Europe in the event of a land war in Europe. And that very greatly limited the initiatives of the United States in that period, and that was the era when Henry Kissinger was telling the military that we see in the Soviet Union the rising imperial empire of the next century, and that his job was to preside over the smooth transition into inferiority, something that Henry, I think, is very much ashamed of today. The status of the world, as the military on both sides saw it, in my judgment, was best expressed to me by the defense minister of China when Musa and I were leaving there in October of 1980, just a month before President Reagan was elected, and at a time when the Soviet press was shrilly denouncing Governor Reagan for what he was saying about Taiwan. The Chinese defense minister said to me, "Today, as a superpower, the United States is perceived as having neither of the two essential attributes. You have neither will nor military capability." He went on to say If your Governor Reagan is elected, you will immediately be perceived as having will, and you have then only to regain your military capability. And of course, that's exactly what President Reagan set out to do when he took office, began the rather major buildup of military forces with all of the inefficiencies that result when you're coming from behind and have to buy quickly and inefficiently. He got the break of the demise of three feeble leaders in a row, Brezhnev, Andropov, and Chernenko, and the USSR continued to deteriorate with regard to its economic capability, observable to even the unsophisticated military of both sides. And when Gorbachev then succeeded Brezhnev, he inherited that situation. I agree with what Jack Wheeler had to say yesterday, that it's clear from the intelligence that Andropov was the one who originally visualized the need for glasnost and perestroika, recognizing, as he did through his KGB service, the best intelligence service in the world probably, the chaotic condition of the Soviet economy. It was literally in a state of chaos. And Gorbachev was clear, recognized that it simply had to be revitalized, and that in the face of the major overseas commitments of money that they were having, the billions of dollars to Cuba and Angola and Mozambique and all the rest, that they were going to have to cut back, and they were going to have to cut back on their central defensive forces. He was astute enough to know that you can't do that with a perceived adversary unless you can cool the tensions with that adversary. And he also recognized that he dare not begin those kind of retrenchments unless he had his military and his party apparatus with him, and that in turn meant that he had to reduce the perceived threat. And he began to do it region by region. In Vietnam, as he began to cut back, he sought to trade off those cutbacks for gain by suggesting that they would give up their hold on bases there and facilities if we did the same in the Philippines. In Japan, he changed the confrontational nature of the Soviet fortification of the Japanese islands into hints that a way could be found to work out that problem. With regard to the Iran-Iraq war, he changed the policy from one of helping whichever side appeared to be losing in order to keep the war going to one of working with us to try to achieve that truce. With regard to the Chinese communist regime's demands, three of them, that the invasion of Afghanistan be liquidated, the Soviet divisions on the border be pulled back, and that Vietnam withdraw from Cambodia, he made performance on all those, having now liquidated his investment in Afghanistan, having leaned hard on the Vietnamese to initiate their withdrawal from Cambodia, and he has pulled back some of the 55 divisions that he had along the Chinese border in an effort to reduce the perception of the threat to the Chinese. In the Indian Ocean, he's reduced dramatically the frequency and size of the naval deployments. He forewent the opportunity to exploit the dissent in Burma. He is doing a low-cost initiative with regard to the Antipodes, where he has urged and encouraged New Zealand's effort to prevent visits by our nuclear ships, and where his ambassador actively encourages Australia to do the same thing, with no success to date. And he continues to arm the Indians, although the Indians are being quite sophisticated about how they deal with that, and indeed have been encouraging visits. They've got me coming down there to visit their Navy in October, and I think they're making it clear that they visualize that their role is quite different from the one that the Soviet Union had visualized. In Africa, he has cooled the situation with regard to Mozambique, urging the leadership there to work with a settlement with the South African-supported insurgency. In Angola and Namibia, the Soviet Union participated in the outcome there that led to the beginning of the evacuation of Cuban troops and the beginning of the departure from colonial status of Namibia. With regard to Ethiopia, he has drastically cut down the aid, and Ethiopia is beginning to make the first feeble noises about getting some help from the West. He has throttled back Gaddafi, which activity, along with our own bombing strikes against Gaddafi, have eased that situation for us. In Eastern Europe, he has announced the withdrawal of tanks and bridging equipment and has announced that he will cut some 500,000 troops. And he has, of course, adopted a quite different policy from the Brezhnev doctrine with regard to the first beginnings of democratic activity in Poland and Hungary, which he has left strictly alone, and has indeed not interfered with the exodus of Germans from East Germany. On the central issues, with regard to the INF treaty, he vindicated President Reagan's decision to stand pat on the double zero, which the liberals in our Congress said would never be achieved, and finally, after some 6 years of negotiations, came all the way across to the U.S. position with regard to the elimination of all of the intermediate and moderate-ranged missiles in Europe. And great progress was made, many, many pages in the Prospective START Treaty, which began to make significant progress after Reykjavik. We've got a long way to go. Most importantly, he has, of course, as we've heard from others, redefined their policy toward class struggle and has paid strong lip service to the interdependence of the world and the need to deal with affairs in that light. And the long-term Soviet support of terrorism, they, of course, began the concept of terrorism, has begun to cool. And interestingly enough, when the Israelis captured Sheikh Obeid, and the U.S. made its usual major deployment of ships to have power available if needed, the Soviet Union, for the first time in a crisis in many years, moved in only a total of 4 ships and kept them well out as intelligence gatherers and did not try to counter our action there. Let me speak now about the military-to-military developments. When President Reagan, after Reykjavik, made his decision that he was going to try to see if we could work over the long haul with Gorbachev. And therefore, both sides agreed that that relationship would change. The military, as you would expect, took their cue from their leaders and began a series of meetings. In December of 1987, during the summit meeting for the signing of the INF Treaty, Marshal Akhramayev, the chief of their general staff, and Admiral Bill Krau, the chairman of our joint staff, got together for breakfast, hit it off very well. Bill Krau took Akhramayev down to the tank where he met with all the chiefs, and they exchanged war stories and had good vibes. Akhramayev, at the age of 66, and Bill Krau, at the age of 64, were at the end of World War II and of that generation. On the 29th of January of 1988, Akhramayev and Krau had a visit, Akhramayev coming to the United States, and he delivered to Krau a 2-year proposed schedule of events to begin to defang the nature of the confrontation between the military. He suggested sports events, war college exchanges of visits, visits of all kinds, including ships and aircraft. He suggested that we begin to look at how to avoid the tensions that come from occasional dangerous instruments. This was not an absolutely new concept. In 1947, we had the Huebner-Malinen Agreement, which led to the stationing of Soviet liaison forces in Frankfurt, reporting to the NATO forces, and U.S. liaison personnel stationed in Potsdam, reporting to the Warsaw Pact commander in an effort to keep confrontations milder than they might otherwise be. And when I was running the Navy back in 1972, we initiated negotiations with the Soviet Union on how to Navy on how to reduce incidents at sea. They'd been doing a lot of bumping of our ships, and we achieved an agreement which led to annual exchanges and reviews. Indeed, on the night that the agreement was signed, it turned out that that was to be the night that the President Nixon, was going to announce the mining of Haiphong Harbor. Our Secretary of the Navy had invited the Russian delegation and Musa and me to come to dinner at 9 o'clock, which was exactly the moment that President Nixon was going to give his speech. I, as a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had been in on the planning, but I was not authorized to tell my civilian superior, Secretary of the Navy, about it until the President started speaking. We handled that by getting to the dinner 5 minutes early, and I broke the rule and told the secretary 5 minutes early. suggested that instead of the Russians finding out about it after they got home, that we invite him in to listen to the president's speech. Musa, with her Russian language capability, did the translating. She threw in an occasional harasha, meaning good, good, which wasn't in the president's text. But the interesting thing was that the Soviet military who were there understood it and expressed to me the fact, you know, that's what a superpower has to do. The political personnel who were there from the Soviet embassy, the then still good communists, were just furious and said, you can't get away with that sort of thing in the face of our power. But of course we did. Those two were the only examples of the kind of work that ensued after the Akramayev and Crow meeting. And the annual visits have been helpful. In March of 1988, Secretary of Defense Carlucci and the Minister of Defense of the Soviet Union, Yazov, met in Bern. In July of 1988, Akramayev made a formal visit to Admiral Crow, not just as previously in the company of his leader. Visited a bomber base, a carrier. He was very impressed with the carrier. Visited a missile site and did some wrapping with the enlisted personnel around. They agreed on that visit to formalize the two-year schedule of events, which would expire in December of 1990, and they agreed that in early 1990 they would come up with a new two-year schedule to continue that kind of increasingly friendly activity. In August of 1988, the two defense ministers got again together for a meeting, and as a result of those two defense minister meetings, during which Carlucci pressed hard for better understandings than the ones that took place when Major Nicholson was shot in that liaison team in Eastern Europe in 1985, better outcomes than recent bumping of U.S. naval ships in the Black Sea as the Soviets sought to embarrass us by being in their ocean, and recent episodes such as the laser blinding of one of our pilots by a Soviet ship. And there was an agreement that we'd work to try to resolve these kind of dangerous incidents. Although the KAL-7 episode was not discussed directly, it was clear that in the milieu of those discussions that that kind of situation would be prevented again. And indeed, I think that the military now feel that that particular corridor is one of the safest corridors for commercial airliners because the Soviets are going to such great lengths not to have a repetition. They agreed to cooperate formally against terrorism and to stop the spread of dangerous technology to third nations and to try to extend Glasnost formally to the military on both sides. That was followed by a visit by a Lieutenant General Butler, the deputy director of our joint staff, to the Soviet Union to work out some specific understandings with regard to the peaceful handling of episodes where an aircraft or a ship was approaching the other's national borders. And for the first time, the Soviets have renounced their right to shoot down an aircraft or to take under fire a ship that strays into territorial waters. And we've agreed now on how to control laser blinding and to renounce jamming of each other's military communications. In the past, the Soviet Union right here in Turkey has tried to lure our aircraft into Russia by false signals, and they've agreed to stop that kind of thing. Both sides have agreed to reduce seek measures to reduce confrontations during times of high tension. As, for example, they talked specifically about how they would both evacuate citizens from Lebanon if that became necessary to avoid confrontations in doing so. In the Persian Gulf episodes, where the Soviets deployed ships into the Persian Gulf, the task force commanders got together and agreed on measures for safety, and we need to do more work because some of their helicopters almost got shot down by straying too close to us. We did warn their ships to stay away from minefields, the location of which we knew, and so that was a higher degree of cooperation than we've ever had in the past, and we're now actually working to establish proven communications between task force commanders, and we're testing that in the Atlantic, in the Pacific, and in Europe. With regard to the future, the commander-in-chief of our European forces is going to visit the commander of the Warsaw Pact shortly, and the superintendents of our National War College and their Voroshilov Academy are going to exchange visits. Interestingly enough, to carry on the development, President Bush has just appointed to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff a member of the new generation, General Colin Powell, who has had all kinds of experience at the national security level in the White House, and Gorbachev has moved Akhramayev out, moderated that act by making him a special advisor to him, and moved in a 52-year-old Marshal Morozov, who has a great deal of national experience. And those two gentlemen, 51 and 52, lacking the blinders of World War II, and with a lot of military political experience, will, I think, be able to carry on to a greater measure this kind of cooperation. Let me now talk on a broader level about the general military situation in the Soviet Union. Their situation is today, in my judgment, quite analogous to what ours was at the end of the Vietnam War in the military. They have, as you heard from Otto von Habsburg, who would have made one heck of an emperor, that they have very low morale, as we did. They have an increasing percentage, more than half now, of their military are of minority background. The greater Russian nationality is being submerged. There is an unprecedented questioning of the Soviet military for the first time since they became legendary heroes in World War II by the populace in general. Before this, there were really two icons of the Soviet Union. One was Lenin and the other was the Soviet military, and the military has lost that status. They had all kinds of drug abuse in Afghanistan, and that continues. Incidentally, as an aside, some of their veterans and some of our veterans of the Vietnam War have met and had discussions about how to deal with the problem of readjustment into a society which has become anti-war. The Soviet public is asking all kinds of questions, and you read about them in the meeting of the Congress, about the military budgets and the size of them. And Gorbachev has, of course, committed himself both before his Congress and before the United Nations to the reduction of forces. We're seeing greater flexibility on the part of the Soviet Union in the conventional force talks in Europe. Gorbachev announced a willingness to come down to equal numbers. They've always insisted on having an asymmetrical advantage in Europe. They're talking now, instead of victory, about, quote, sufficient defense, unquote. And with regard to the announced cuts that Gorbachev enunciated before the United Nations, they're moving much more slowly than we would like. Some tanks have been removed from Europe. They have not been destroyed. Some of them have had their guns removed. Our intelligence estimate is that it'll take 5 to 10 years for Gorbachev to make those reductions. I think we may see him go a little bit faster just because of his own internal budget pressures, but he hasn't reduced Soldier One to date. Interestingly enough, their long-term procurement was up in 1988 in spite of all those pronouncements. The purchase of new equipment went up. And when Akhramayev was questioned about that when he went before our U.S. Senate recently, he just tossed it off by saying that our Defense Intelligence Agency was wrong, but they're not. Their naval deployments have been reduced 20 to 25%. They're doing more coastal work and less overseas work. Their force levels, we estimate, in the Navy will go down by about 20% by 1996. They are probably going to eliminate one of their Kiev-class carriers. They're no longer keeping their Yankee ballistic missile submarines 400 or 500 miles off our coast, but instead are keeping them back in the Soviet Union for greater protection. And when Colonel Higgins was murdered, or at least when the announcement of the murder occurred, he probably was murdered earlier, again, the Soviets did not deploy a significant number of ships to the Med as they have in the past. Their military maneuvers are showing more defensive tactics rather than simulated strikes against us. And the Bear aircraft that were flying out of Vietnam and Syria and Angola and Cuba have been greatly reduced in numbers. At the higher level of developments, it's interesting, and this is, I think, quite pertinent to the analysis of just how fast the revolution will come, that Gorbachev has replaced 18 or 19 of the 22 most senior military, beginning with that young Morozov at the general staff level. And he's moved up into those positions, much younger, more educated, brighter military people. Indeed, interestingly enough, our civilian defense officials believe that they are more articulate in many cases than our own current military, and that they have a freer hand with regard to what they can say in public than our military, which is a dramatic change in the relative situation. The Soviets are clearly using their military to try to persuade our military to make some concessions with regard to the naval aspects of arms control. They're trying to get us to admit that naval cruise missiles should be eliminated because you can't distinguish between nuclear and conventional missiles. What they really mean, of course, is that this would reduce our capability to reinforce Europe in a war. They're trying to get us to take nuclear warheads off of our naval craft without yet agreeing with us as to how we could verify a similar act on their part. And they're trying to persuade us to cut our forces. I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. Let me say that in his aside with Admiral Crowe at one of the last of their four meetings, Akhramayev said to him, you know, with regard to the ocean, we would be prepared to give up, for example, 200 of our attack submarines. They have 350 of them. If you would give up 5 of your attack carriers, we have 15 of those. So that was not an unreasonable proposal, but it shows the extent to which they worry about our capability to reinforce Europe. What are the opportunities and challenges for our military as a result of this dramatically changing situation? First, I think we've got a real job to teach the Soviet military of why we need to have the naval capability that we have, not only to be able to reinforce Europe as a deterrent to their actions, but because we have responsibilities in an oceanic alliance that are far greater than the ones that they have, the need to support Western Pacific allies, something that we lost the capability to do during the Nixon, Ford, Carter years and have only regained in the naval buildup of the Reagan years, and the need increasingly to participate in such things as the drug actions down in Colombia and so forth. We need to work hard with the Soviet Union to understand their strategic and tactical doctrine and to teach them ours so that there is a better understanding on both sides that we are defensive. We clearly are, and I think over time that our military can make more progress in urging the Soviet Union to be defensive in their approach. The military are going to be far better than civilians at working on the details of how to verify arms control proposals, and we see more interest developing in that on both sides in the military. We need to exchange better than we are today information on procurements and research and development. The Soviets, of course, have their attachés listening to all of our congressional testimony. We have much more difficulty getting theirs, but they are being more open with us now. We have a lot to teach them about nuclear safety so that their military will avoid the loss of these nuclear submarines. We have a perfect record with regard to our seagoing nuclear reactors, and we operate more than any country in the world, and we can teach them a lot there. When Akhramayev talked to Admiral Crowe, he suggested sort of tongue-in-cheek that both sides were going to have trouble convincing their respective civilian authorities on the need for bigger military budgets, the friendlier they got. And that was in the context that he then suggested that for that reason they might make these reductions of the nuclear carriers versus the attack submarines. And there is, I think, merit in continuing those kind of discussions because it's clear that civilian pressures on both sides are going to force cuts, and the military will be happier and more comfortable with each other if there have been discussions about making them move toward equality on both sides. In summary, then, I would say that the general picture with regard to the military aspects of what's going on in the Soviet Union is that their heretofore wholesale support of wars of national liberation has clearly ended. Afghanistan was a major success, but is not yet final. The Soviets, by their removal of forces, I think wisely foresaw that the 10 or 12 different factions in the Afghanistan tribal warfare would begin to fight among each other, and that has happened, and the success that the West anticipated they would have has not come to pass, and we may find that what ends up in Afghanistan is, after all, a pro-Soviet state. I hope that we can avoid that by intelligent diplomacy from here on. There is one dramatic exception to the regional cooling of tensions, and that is what's going on in Central America. There, the Central Soviet strategy we have known for a long time. It is the intelligent strategy that any military man would advocate geopolitically. I'd be advocating it if I were a Soviet general. And that was to first achieve control of Nicaragua, to use Nicaragua to achieve control of the rest of the isthmus, as they are seeking to in El Salvador, ultimately the Panama Canal, to use their military infrastructure in Central America then to be able to separate the two continents, North and South America, in war, to use their military position there and in Cuba to begin the movement of Mexico from a socialist neutral state to a Marxist pro-Soviet state, and then to use the border of Mexico to sow agents of drugs and terror across the United States, thereby forcing us to remove forces from Europe, leaving Europe prostrate. Now, that was part of their strategy. It's, of course, been essentially renounced by Gorbachev, but his party and elements of his military still dearly believe in that strategy. And I believe that one of the accommodations he has had to make to the military is to keep the action going in Nicaragua. Even though our Congress killed aid to the Contras, the Soviet Union has increased its aid to Nicaragua, and Nicaragua is supporting with that equipment the leftist insurgency in El Salvador. The Soviets, of course, have two other things working for them in Central America. One is Castro, and the other is the Contradora powers, whose policies seem to match very closely what Moscow would ask them to do. They are carrying out some aggressive diplomacy in spite of this new policy of theirs worldwide, with those shipment of weapons, with their actions in New Zealand and Australia with regard to our nuclear visits, and with their continued efforts to acquire fishing rights, potential military bases in the islands of the Pacific. But they have reduced to minor degree the physical involvement of their forces in the Persian Gulf, in the Sheikh Obeid situation, and so forth. Now, Gorbachev, we know from our intelligence sources, is telling his party apparatus and his military, look, fellas, I need 15 years to turn this economic situation around. Give me that kind of time, and then you'll see us return to our march toward hegemony. That's what he ought to be saying as a good politician in order to keep those hardliners passive. And whether he means it or not, only his wife and his mother know. But the question I think that we have to keep in mind as we view the rate at which we make our own defense reductions, and this I think is the best explanation for what I consider to be President Bush's very intelligent caution to date, that Gorbachev may well not make it. I've been saying in my comments around the country that I thought he only had about a 40% prospect of survival over the next 5 years. I asked Manfred Warner at dinner the other night what number he put on it, and he came up with exactly the same percentage. I gather from our analysts here that they would, in some cases, place that even lower. There's another way in which the hardliners could return, and that is because Gorbachev is such an astute politician. If he feels that he's losing out, he could himself reverse course 180 degrees and restore a more disciplined dictatorship to the Soviet Union. There is one issue which, in my judgment, is likely to unite the greater Russian population to a degree that they are not united to date, and that is the continued effort on the part of these individual nationalities to move towards sovereignty. The Russian military and the greater Russian citizenry, I think, will come together in opposition to any covert or rather overt effort to achieve total freedom from the Soviet bloc. I think if the Baltic nations and the nations of Central Asia are wise, they will work toward the achievement of internal sovereignty, control of everything except their defense and foreign policy, and stop short at the current phase of going beyond that, because I believe that you'll see, even in spite of the fact that over 50% of the Soviet military come from those various nationalities, I think you'll see a smashing of any effort to leave the Soviet bloc on the part of the nations which make up the Soviet Union proper. And I think that over time, the role of our military in working with and educating the Soviet Union military can be a very sophisticated one. As we study these developments of the magnificent prospect of a unified Europe, of a forthcoming common market of North America, of the rapidly burgeoning economies in Asia, as we watch them begin, in the case of the European common market, to wean away Eastern European satellites, in the case of our common market, to begin to approve through associate membership the economies of Mexico and Central America, as we begin to see the so-called third world nations beginning to improve their economy with the economic support that they get from these huge economic combinations, the role of our military is going to be first to understand the change in the nature of the competition and to do their best to put that across to the Soviet Union and to try to keep their military reasonably passive as dramatic changes take place in their empire. I'll be very happy to take your questions. Yes? First, let me say that I believe that Jack Wheeler's scenario is one possible scenario rather than, as he suggested it, the thing that's going to happen. I believe there are 100 scenarios that one can come up with, and I don't think that given the tremendous multidimensional nature of the various vectors that are working there, that one can really predict whether Gorbachev will be successful, whether he'll reverse course, whether he'll be succeeded by a hardliner who will hold the empire together. There's a whole series of layers of things that one can visualize. But assuming that his analysis is correct and that does happen, the Soviet military has been every bit as careful as our military has been to keep very taut control over their nuclear weapons. And I believe that because they understand the horrible nature of the misuse of one of those nuclear weapons, and Chernobyl has taught their civilian leadership in spades how what was for them a relatively minor episode in comparison to a nuclear warhead had such major effects. I think you will see those nuclear weapons brought back into a centralized storage in the case of any kind of deterioration of the type that Jack Wheeler is talking about. And it'll be the last thing to go. Even their hordes of gold would go before they'll give up their possession of those nuclear weapons to a revolutionary regime.
Yes? Could you expand on that for just a minute and give us an indication of where their land-based missiles are concentrated? Are they in the Ukraine, Georgia, the Baltic states?
For purposes of survival, their weapons were scattered all through Eastern Europe and Western Russia, with just a few in Siberia, because they didn't need as much firepower focused on China and Japan. Under the INF Treaty, they are required over time and are in the process of removing all but their battlefield nuclear weapons from Western Europe, as we are from Eastern Europe, as we are from Western Europe. But the weapons are quite widely scattered in Russia and Siberia.
This completes the first part of this program. Please turn over for the continuation of the program.